Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And with us now, former PBS NewsHour anchor Jim Lehrer, no relation, to talk about his new book and to recall where he was 50 years ago next month, covering the assassination of President John F. Kennedy as a reporter for the Dallas Times-Herald, November 22, 1963. Jim's new book is a novel set against the Kennedy assassination that revolves around one of the more minor players in the real-life history-changing drama. We'll also get Jim's 50-year take on dysfunction in Washington. The book is called Top Down, a novel of the Kennedy assassination. Jim Lehrer, welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, always a pleasure to see you, cousin.
So what was your assignment on November 22nd, 1963? What were you covering before you knew the president was shot?
I was working for the afternoon paper, the Dallas Times-Herald. I was the federal reporter, but the Kennedys were only going to be in Dallas for 3 hours, right in the middle of the day. So the entire city staff was working on the story.
And by the way, that's a quaint notion right there, the afternoon paper.
There used to be those. Yeah.
And afternoon papers.
Exactly. My assignment was to cover the arrival of the Kennedys at Love Field and then stay there and cover their departure.
Love Field was the name of
Dallas
the airport.
Dallas Love Field, that was the airport where the Kennedys were coming in and out of. And
Was that named after the state of love or a person?
That was named after a person who lived in Dallas, a prominent person. And My story was simply that because it was an afternoon newspaper, this was happening right on deadline. The newspaper I worked for is a very cheap newspaper, but for some reason they sprung to have an open telephone line for me so I could talk to the rewrite desk downtown. And we were checking the telephone lines, and the rewrite man says to me, we'd gotten a 20-minute alert that the Air Force One was taking off from Fort Worth, just a short flight. And the rewrite man says, I'm going to be writing under deadline, is the bubble top going to be on the presidential limousine when it comes through Dallas on the motorcade? And I said, well, I can't see. The motorcade cars are parked down a ramp. He said, would you mind going down there and seeing? I said, why? And he said, because I'm going to be writing, blah, 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 you know. So I put the phone down. I went down to the top of the ramp. And because I was a federal, standing at the top of the ramp, I could see the cars. There were six cars, including the presidential limousine, and the bubble top was, in fact, over the car. And this was strictly a weather decision. It had been raining that morning in Dallas, et cetera. So anyhow, I knew this Secret Service agent because he was the Dallas office. He was in charge of the Dallas office. So I asked him, I said, look, rewrite wants to know, are you going to take the bubble top down? And so he kind of looks up, I'll never forget, he looks up at the sky and he says, well, it's clear. And he yells at another agent, he's got a two-way radio, and he says, check it downtown. So the guy, blah, 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 and he says, clear downtown. So then the agent yells at the other agents who are around the cars and says, lose the bubble top. So they did. Now, the bubble top was six pieces of quarter-inch thick plexiglass put together with snaps. That's all. It wasn't bulletproof. It was designed for weather purposes to keep people from getting wet. And I watched while they took it down, and then I went to rewrite, and I said, yeah, they're taking the bubble top down, and then events went on from there.
And hence the title of the novel, Top Down, which revolves around this Secret Service agent.
Absolutely right. And that Secret Service agent, the real Secret Service agent, and we'll get to the fictional one in a moment, the real Secret Service agent, at midnight, after the word comes that their shots have been fired at the president and the president, I was sent to first to Parkland Hospital and then to the police station. I was at midnight that night, the night of the assassination, I was at the police station, which Brian, I can tell you, was the most horrendous scene I've ever been in my life. I'll never be anything like that again. The mixture of agents and cops and reporters with all kinds of dialects and stuff. At any rate, Somebody told me there was a meeting going on upstairs, midnight. So there's a meeting going upstairs, the police chief's office. I go up there, and the door is closed, and I decide to wait, see what happens. And I didn't know who was in the meeting. So in a few minutes, the door finally opens, and they got five or six guys in suits come out, and one of them is this Secret Service agent, the guy, the real guy who had made the decision. Well, he sees me. And he was an old man. You know, he's like 42 years old or something like that.
Old compared to the Cub reporter for the Dallas Afternoon paper.
Exactly. And so the agent comes over to me. I may have imagined this. I don't know. But from what I recall, there were tears in his eyes. The man came to me and he said, "Oh, Jim, if I just hadn't taken off the bubble top." And I thought to myself, "Oh my God! If I just hadn't asked the question, you know, and it, you know, the what ifs. I mean, that, the Kennedy assassination, like all major events, but the Kennedy assassination in particular, is full of thousands of what ifs. What if somebody had done this? What if somebody had done that? Maybe this wouldn't have happened, et cetera." And this was one of them.
And you make the point, you made it before, that the car top was not meant to be bulletproof or protect the president from anything but rain.
That's right.
And yet if somebody wants to second-guess themselves, I guess any material there could have redirected a bullet, including 2 inches of plexiglass, and made an assassination attempt much harder.
Exactly. Or the assassin might have did not know whether or not this was bubble top, might have decided not even to take the shots. Because there were even some Secret Service agents who thought this glass was bulletproof. Or if they had, as you say, could have deflected it. Now, the other theory is, there's a counter theory, that if the assassin had gone ahead and fired those three rounds, that the glass would have exploded into all kinds of horrendous shards and probably killed everybody in the car. Wow. Both the Kennedys, both the Connollys, and maybe the two Secret Service agents who were driving in the front seat.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio. Brian Lehrer with Jim Lehrer, no relation, the PBS NewsHour. What do you say, anchor emeritus?
And, well, I'm still the executive editor of the NewsHour, but I don't have hands-on control, and I'm not on the air anymore at all.
And author of the book Top Down, a novel of the Kennedy assassination. I've seen you quoted saying Kennedy broke with protocol to shake hands with members of a crowd somewhere, and you said everything about it struck you as extraordinary.
Yeah.
True?
Well, yeah, at Love Field, he, you know, there was a fence there where the public was, but he insisted on going and shaking hands and all of that. This was why the bubble top was taken. The bubble top was taken down. He, under his orders, he had always said, "Look, if we're going to have a motorcade or a public event, I don't want to be under glass. I don't want to be seen hiding," because here again, there was no thought of a protective thing.
But did that assassination end the era of shaking hands on rope lines and riding with tops down in presidential motorcades forever?
It just about did, absolutely. It changed many, many things, Brian, for people in the news business and people throughout the world in terms of their attitudes about the next phone call or the next event, whatever. It was a fragile forever revelation for everybody involved that we are fragile.
So you had this fleeting interaction after the shooting with the Secret Service agent who you think you picked up a little glint of guilt in his eyes. And now you have the fictional character based on him. And he tries to, really his family tries to reenact the shooting to assuage that guilt, to show him that it wouldn't have made a difference?
Wouldn't have made a difference. Because in the novel, now we're in the fiction part, in the novel the agent becomes so guilt-ridden that he suffers from what would now be called PTSD. And it becomes a mental problem, and then some of these severe cases, it also became physical. And became so physical that his 20-year-old daughter, this was 5 years later, in 1968, his 20-year-old daughter is afraid that he's going to die because of this. It's going to take his life. That guilt is going. He's going to die from guilt, and so she, through a set of circumstances, comes across a young reporter, newspaper reporter, who was in Dallas at that time. Would have been 5 years earlier.
Based on guess who?
Based on me. Yeah, exactly. And she contacts him, and the two of them, make an effort to try to convince her father that he should not feel guilty because of this. He should not feel this guilt. And as you say, there's a reenactment kind of thing and a lot of other things.
No spoiler alert, right?
No.
No spoiler.
No spoiler. No further. Right. We won't go any further than that.
From a media standpoint, one of the amazing things about the journalist who covered the story is how many of you went on to become network anchors.
Yeah.
Bob Schieffer was there for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Robin McNeil, later to become your co-anchor on the NewsHour, was there for NBC. Peter Jennings was a Canadian journalist who flew to Dallas from Toronto to report. And Dan Rather for CBS.
President Kennedy was sitting on the same side of the car as the building from which the shot came. Mrs. Kennedy was by his side in the jump seat in front of him. Mrs. Connolly and Governor Connolly. Governor Connolly on the same side of the car as the president, and in the front seat, two Secret Service men. Just as the president put that right hand up to the side of his head, you could see him lurch forward. The first shot had hit him.
That's Dan Rather a few days later on CBS narrating the home movie that was made of part of the incident by a guy named Abraham Zapruder. Jim, can you imagine if that was today? There would be a million cell phone videos giving investigators every possible angle.
Absolutely. I've thought about that, particularly after the Boston Marathon explosion. I thought, oh, my goodness, if this had happened on November 22nd, 1963, they'd still be looking at the various photographs and moving pictures.
Was it a giant coincidence that so many future network anchors from, you know, all over the place were on the story that day? Or, did that credential help launch all your careers to another level?
You know, I don't know. Brian, I hadn't thought of it till this very moment. That I don't see it as a launching necessarily. I do know this. I do know that everyone that I know personally and know well, that means McNeil, Schieffer, Letso, Rather, every one of us, and print people as well, every reporter that I know personally who was involved in any way with the assassination coverage, either that day, but most particularly that day, but afterward, was changed in terms of their added. I know, I'll just speak for myself. I had been a reporter for 4 years, maybe 5 years, when that happened, and from that day on to this day, I have been aware that the next phone call could bring something terrible. It comes back to my word earlier, the fragility of it all, and the Kennedy assassination is what started it all. But then, of course, there was the Robert F. Kennedy assassination and the Martin Luther King assassination, and then there was Vietnam, and then there was Watergate, all these horrendous things. But the John F. Kennedy assassination was the first of these. And those of us who were in the news business, for instance, I later became city editor of that afternoon newspaper, and I told everybody on the staff, I don't want to hear a telephone ring that isn't answered in this newsroom. Mm. Who knows what might be happening? And we're all that way, every one of us.
That's PTSD in itself.
You are exactly right.
Hypervigilance.
You're exactly right.
And you were all, you and Schieffer and Rather, all from Texas, right?
Yeah. That's just a very good coincidence.
You know, Lehrers aren't supposed to be from Texas. We're supposed to be from places like Poland and the Lower East Side.
Yeah. Well, my dad, Fred Lehrer, was born in West Orange, New Jersey. Is that good enough? Does that work for you?
Yeah, we'll take that.
Okay.
You know, I actually think many New Yorkers of that era, and I'm serious about this, hold it a little bit against Texas that Kennedy was shot there. Like, of course, if this was going to happen, it would happen in reactionary Dallas.
Yeah.
Do you think it was more likely to happen in Dallas for any reason?
Well, let me tell you what happened. That when I got the word, I was still at Love Field when I got the word that that Kennedy had been shot. And I immediately, after I got through to the city, I don't know, but I did. Then I hung up the phone and then immediately called my home and got my wife on the phone. And what I said to her was, darling, let's get the hell out of here. I mean, meaning here, meaning Dallas. In other words, my reaction was the same as everybody else's, that because of the right-wing stuff, there had been some earlier attacks or protests against Adlai Stevenson, some other stuff. And the immediate reaction was it had to be a right-winger. And, of course, it turned out not to be the case, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that was the immediate reaction.
So, you know, after that, I have to ask what you think really happened. Was it Oswald acting alone, one man, one bullet, as the official investigation led by Chief Justice Earl Warren at the time concluded? Or do you, having covered this, you know, one way or another for many years, give credence to any of the conspiracy theories?
I don't give any credence to any specific conspiracy theory. But I always have had an open mind about it. Remember, I spent, well, you don't remember because I'm just now telling you, I spent 6-7 months every day covering the aftermath of the assassination.
You did
every
right
part
at,
of the
right
investigation.
Afterwards, those
yeah,
next six, 7 months.
I was assigned to do that by the Times-Herald. And I ran down every conspiracy theory that we could come up with because, remember, there was no Pulitzer Prize to be won proving that it, one guy acted alone. So we were, thesis for me and for the 2,000 other reporters was there was a conspiracy there. We were looking for it. We never found it.
There was a House committee in 1979 that concluded a high probability that two gunmen were involved.
Yeah, I read that. I covered that. And but their thesis didn't hold water to me in the long run. My theory, my personal thing, Brian, has always been that, okay, I always expected that one day the bell of what they used to call the old wire machines with the bells would ring, and then we'd get a bulletin that some guy on his deathbed said, "Okay, confesses I was Oswald's driver. I was Oswald's this. I did this." You know, and there was a conspiracy. But now we sit here 50 years later, Brian, and that the bells have yet to ring, and there's been no evidence that I am aware of. That at least the evidence I'm aware of has not convinced me mm-hmm. that there was anything other than the single person. But I'm not absolutely sure. I am just pretty sure, okay?
So before you go, and recalling that you said you moved away, you and your wife said you got to move out of Dallas to get away from all this right-wing stuff. So you moved to Washington.
Oh, that's called a segue, isn't it?
Is today, with all your years, you did McNeil Air and then, you know, NewsHour in Washington. Is today the height of power in Washington for that strain of conservatism that we now call the Tea Party?
Brian, I don't see a direct connection. The right wing in Dallas that existed in that time.
I don't mean that there's a connection between.
Oh, no, I know, but that was those people were motivated more by international events.
Mm-hmm.
They were not anti-government per se. They were not Tea Party people in protest of anything. They were afraid the communists were going to get us all. That was their motivation, and these folks are driven by a different fear that the United States government's going to get us all. And that's
right.
A huge difference.
Is today, with all your experience, the most polarized you've ever seen Washington politics?
Oh, I've never seen anything like it. I never thought anything like this would ever happen. What is really weird about it, not weird, but what is significant to me about it, is that, you know, anybody who covers politics for more than 3 days realizes that it's the moderates, the people in the middle who run this country. They are the people who elect presidents, but they do everything but nominate candidates. The people on the wings do that. But in the middle is where they govern. We always govern in the middle. And this is the first time in my experience that the middle somehow didn't hold, that the moderates didn't rise up because they don't organize. You know, the big middle, that's the majority of Americans, they're not organized. And they don't have a leader in this case. And as it's time for somebody probably to assume that leadership. And my, because that's where all the people are. You just read the polls on this issue, and you see that's where the majority is.
Do you remember in all your years in the anchor's chair and listening to your political analysts, Gergen and Shields, and Shields and Gigot, and Shields and Brooks? Did I leave out any generation
of
it?
You got them.
Ever do anything on a potential missing of the debt ceiling until 2011?
No. Something like that wouldn't even be unheard of. Because, see, that's where, because in the middle was, no matter what the arguments were, you could go to the far left or the far right, and everybody had their arguments, but in the final analysis, they came together in some form to move the government along. And this is the first time, see, government is there to protect people from catastrophe. This is the first time the government itself has created a catastrophe right before our very eyes.
Jim Lehrer, still executive editor of the PBS NewsHour, still no relation, and author now of Top Down, a novel of the Kennedy assassination. Thank you, as always.
Thank you, Brian, as always.